From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made in the Supreme Court decision that overturned decades of campaign finance law. We're talking about Citizens United. Now, if you recall Mitt Romney's famous comment that corporations are people, you might associate that idea with Citizens United. But Justice Anthony Kennedy authored an opinion that took it beyond that simple concept. As noted by Vox.com, Kennedy's opinion was, quote, about viewing all politics as a form of market activity. The question, as he saw it, was how to preserve a political marketplace. In this market-centric view, democracy, access, voice, and other democratic values are flattened, replaced with a thin veneer of political activity as a type of capital right. End quote. And we're getting a little wonky here, but here's where I'm going with this. Justice Kennedy applied the market to a sphere where it doesn't have to go. And that's also true for healthcare, for prison, for education. The devotion to markets is not at all simply a conservative idea. Progressives have increasingly followed this idea, especially since the 1980s. And so if healthcare is not viewed as a right, but a commodity, and if education is viewed in terms of markets, not egalitarianism, well, our guests will elaborate on what that could mean for us. There's a word that defines this broad concept, and it's a word that I'm seeing just about everywhere these days. Some think it's overblown or misunderstood. Some think it's vitally important to grasp it. The word is neoliberalism, and this hour our guests will do their best to make sure we can recognize it when we see it in the wild. Those guests are Lyle Rubin, who is a PhD candidate in history at the University of Rochester. He's writing his dissertation on left-leaning uses of Adam Smith and market economics in the United States. He's co-founder of Rochester Democratic Socialists of America, and someone I know well, one of his colleagues, says that he is one of the smartest voices on neoliberalism anywhere. So, no pressure. Thank you for being here.
I'm happy to be here. Thanks for having me.
It's a pretty good intro, huh?
Oh, I couldn't ask for anything better.
Also here is David Hirsch. He's a professor of teaching and curriculum at the University of Rochester's Warner School of Education. And David reached out to me recently after a program in which I brought up just the idea of neoliberalism. I've been trying, David, to sort of call it out when I see it or see it as I understand it. And certainly, my understanding might not be nearly full enough. But you reached out. Why did you reach out to me recently? I think it was just kind of a good. You think it was a good moment to define the term?
It was a good moment, but I think we're hearing it more and more.
Yeah.
And I think it's important to try to understand what it is. But it's also very difficult to understand what it is because there's many different kinds of definitions. In fact, I've just finished a paper that talks about five kinds of neoliberalism. I think it's very complicated, but I think basically in the United States, we tend to shy away from economics, and then particularly economic theory, and neoliberalism is a form of economic theory, and I think we need to dive into it and try to sort it out, and it's not as if we're going to sort it out in an hour or a year, but we need to keep on engaging in a discussion and trying to figure it out, because it influences everything we do, as you just said, health, schooling, et cetera.
I had a guest, and I don't remember who it was, but recently I asked the guest to sort of distill in a short paragraph a concept, and he said, Evan, your show has never asked anyone to do that, so I'm not going to do it either. And I took that as a compliment. Neoliberalism cannot be distilled into a paragraph, but Lyle, I'll start with you, because what I do want to do is try to at least give an introductory idea of neoliberalism before we dive into it, because I don't want people's ears and eyes to glaze over. This is very important right now. This particular political moment, the next hour, we're going to talk about what the left does next. Bernie Sanders is already going back to Iowa. He hasn't really stopped campaigning. There's a big new New Yorker piece about that. And the questions of, you know, what are the ideas? Is it time to be idealistic or pragmatic? What can the left do to win? I think neoliberalism is baked into that discussion. Mm-hmm. So let's start with how, when you bump into people who have no clue what the concept is, and they go, Lyle, help me out here. And you go, like, do you have an hour? Do you have six? But they don't. What's the easy way to kind of get going with understanding what neoliberalism
is? So the best definition I've ever heard came from a social theorist by the name of Adolf Reed. And he basically describes it in two ways. He describes it as an ideology, a way of thinking that tends to talk about free markets, small government, innovation. But in reality, materially, what it really is a program designed to redistribute wealth and power upward. So if you look at a lot of the policies of the past 30, 40 years, they have been marketed in the language of the market. And yet, they have been willing, wherever necessary, to use state power and to use the government to ensure that wealth and power continues to be redistributed upward.
And before David wants to jump in, he's chomping at the bit already. Intentionally, or are there some neoliberals who who really sort of have an idealistic view, a faith in markets, and they wouldn't tell you that intentionally it's about redistributing wealth upward.
Absolutely. There's all sorts of different groups that are part of this history. There are the intellectuals, go back all the way to the beginning of the 20th century, and they were genuine, and their goal was to find some middle ground, some middle way between laissez-faire liberalism, so totally unregulated markets, and what they saw as the rise of socialist states. I would say that they're genuine and they really believe what they said. But then by the time FDR, Franklin Roosevelt came around and the New Deal came around, you had a lot of corporate actors that were primarily interested in maintaining or increasing their bottom line and were more than willing to co-opt these early stage neoliberal ideas for their own purposes.
Okay, one more quick follow, and then we'll turn to David for some of his ideas on this. Jonathan Chait, your favorite writer, Lyle, probably not your favorite writer, wrote a piece recently for New York Magazine in which he came close to sort of lampooning the conversations about neoliberalism, because he kind of says, well, if it means everything, it means nothing. Or if everybody can be roped in, it kind of means nothing. And let me just read from Chait a little bit, because he says, look, if Democrats and Republicans, if liberals and conservatives are both neoliberals, then how can that mean much of anything? He writes the following in New York Magazine, quote, in the international context, neoliberal means capitalist, as distinguished from socialist. That meaning has rarely had much application in American politics because liberals and conservatives both believe, to starkly differing degrees, in capitalism. If neoliberal simply describes a belief in some role for market forces, then it is literally true that liberals and conservatives are both neoliberal. It is strange, though, to apply a single term to opposing combatants in America's increasingly bitter partisan struggle. If the party that created Obamacare and the party trying to destroy it, the party of higher taxes on the rich and the party of lower, the party of tighter pollution limits and the party of allowing oil drillers to write regulations are each neoliberal, then neoliberalism is of a limited use in describing American politics. Thoughts on that?
Right. So I first want to say that I think he's correct that the term neoliberal is often used in too broad a sense. It is used as an insult, an epithet, in ways that I would consider inexact. Where I disagree with Chait is I do still think that the Democrats he speaks of are still neoliberals, but they're a different kind of neoliberal than their Republican counterparts. The distinction that I would make is Republicans tend to be what I would call reactionary neoliberals, where the Democrats tend to be progressive neoliberals. So when I say that they're both neoliberals, they both proceed from this kind of late 1970s moment that really started not with Ronald Reagan, but with Jimmy Carter, where they were skeptical of labor unions, skeptical of top marginal tax rates, very enthusiastic about ways of introducing the market mechanism into government, into public-private partnerships.
Hands off on corporate concentration?
Right. Hands off on certainly the deregulation program has been bipartisan regulation. A lot of the financial problems we've seen
antitrust.
Since 2008. Right, antitrust. We can talk about that later. But they've more or less been in agreement. So whereas the Republicans, enthusiastically supported something like welfare reform and wanted to cut everything else as well, Social Security and Medicaid, the Democrats also were interested in cutting the entitlements, cutting welfare, but as a kind of compensating measure would also be for something like a raise in the earned income tax credit. So it was kind of a softer version of the Republican version.
Which saw a lot of that in the mid-90s, yeah?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
Okay. So, for our progressive listeners going, aren't you just describing the right? He's describing Clinton-era Democrats for the most part, broadly speaking. Obama-era Democrats?
I would argue yes.
Okay. Yeah. David, so go ahead here. Pick us up. Where do you want to go next with this?
A lot of places, so I have to choose one.
Well, we've got much of an hour here. Go ahead, Professor.
So you said... Obama Democrats. I mean, one would be, and one of we're going to talk about education, is basically Obama and Duncan were arguing a neoliberal arguments.
Arne Duncan is who you're talking about. Yeah.
Yes, Arne Duncan, arguing for basically neoliberal approach to education, because they were talking about privatizing schools, the charter schools competing with each other, and that would improve education, schools as markets. And so they were laying the groundwork for what's being described now by Betsy DeVos, Secretary of Education, and Donald Trump. So in some ways, they're very similar. And actually, in my most recent book, The End of Public Schools, which is basically saying that neoliberalism is the model for what is going on in education now, the book is, because it was written a year and a half ago, is a critique of Duncan, Obama, and Cuomo, and other, and Democrats, because they were the ones who were in the position of making educational policy. But I've been arguing is that there's a number of different kinds of neoliberals, and you, and Lau just said progressive and also culturally conservative neoliberals. And so we need to be aware of those differences. Also, just aware that you mentioned that the critique was that as long as people believe in some role for markets, then we're all the same. And what I would argue is, yes, nobody's at this point that I know of is going to argue that that markets are not some way in which we distribute things or decide what's to be made and produced and sold. So markets have their role. So by claiming that, if you're claiming that anybody who believes in markets is a neoliberal, basically that says neoliberalism is not a valuable concept. But in fact, that's not the distinction that I would make is believing in markets. One is believing in markets and thinking that whatever the outcome is. So you ask the question whether the belief that there's more inequality or creating inequality is intentional. And yet what I've read from neoliberals saying, well, markets do lead to inequalities. If you try to remedy that inequality by having the state intervene in particular ways in terms of more welfare spending, health care for the poor, et cetera, they argue that that creates that the neoliberalism in the market is the most efficient mechanism we have, and anything that interferes in that is inefficient and therefore should be avoided. So, in fact, anything that creates less inequality is inefficient and should be discarded. So neoliberals, therefore, will develop policies that resulted well, the aim is not to have any policies because neoliberalism ideally would like to get rid of government. But what you want to have is the market make the decisions.
And is that a little extreme, you think?
Which is extreme.
You said get rid of government?
Well, that's what, you know, ideally in the phrase has been.
You mean strip down regulation?
That the government should have, the government's role should be reduced to military, police, very minor. And, you know, you do read from some neoliberals who talk about that roads, there should be no road construction paid for by the state or the federal government. It should be paid by individuals meeting with their neighbors and deciding.
Now, our listeners are going, no, David, you're describing libertarians.
I don't think I think I'm also describing some neoliberals now. And some of these are ones who have regular columns in newspapers. They're not the ones that I am worried about because I think their ideas don't make any sense.
Because our listeners are saying, wait a second, Lyle just said mid-90s Clinton era,
yeah.
Obama era Democrats probably fit the bill of what he's describing,
yes,
as neoliberalism.
They
are not people who want our neighbors to pay
not.
For roads.
And that's why there's different kinds of neoliberalism,
okay.
Some that want to privatize everything, no role for government, and other ones, clearly, well, I mean, one of the contradictions of neoliberalism is if you want to create charter schools, privatize education that way, vouchers, markets, testing, test scores, and all of that, that in fact requires government to have a role in education. So what I find is that neoliberalism is contradictory in saying we need to get rid of government's role, we need to reduce it as much as possible, and then in fact the federal government now plays a much larger role in education than it ever has, because it needs to do that in order to create the system. They don't want getting away from the idea of local schools and towards the idea of marketization. So government gets larger.
So let me ask you,
neoliberals are trying to reduce the size of government, they haven't been doing that in many of their policies.
David, we have listeners, undoubtedly,
yes,
who believe very strongly in the power of the market. That
yes.
The market is a pretty efficient actor when
right.
you allow it to operate
sort of
on its own. And yes, the market creates winners and losers, but mm-hmm. there is something much more efficient about that. So let's back
right.
it up and tell our listeners, especially when it comes to education,
mm-hmm.
which is your specialty, what's wrong with markets involved with education?
As it's involved with education, one of the terms that hasn't gotten mentioned is the notion of freedom. And so neoliberals want to argue that freedom entails the individual choice, and that we need to be able to give people as much individual choice as possible. Of course, I'm not against freedom and not against the idea of people making choices when it's appropriate. But what neoliberalism approach to education leads to the idea that you should have markets in education, you should have choice and competition, some way of measuring whether schools are, when some schools are better than others, which leads to standardized tests and test scores. And it leads to, and the idea under neoliberalism for markets and choice is that schools will compete with each other, and those schools that are better will attract students away from the schools that aren't doing as well. And therefore, that will improve the educational system. That's the theory under a neoliberal approach to education.
But it's a spiral for the schools already struggling?
It is. There's no research showing that that actually improves what goes on in schools. In fact, what we have in New York and many places, as we get into privatizing or charter schools, we're having, in fact, more segregation by race and by class. But it does lead, and there's research on this. In England, there was the students and families had the choices of what schools to go to, but they had to be the schools that were already doing well, that already were advantaged in large part because they had attracted students from more middle-class families, chose students who were already doing well and would do well in their school. And so we saw in England is those schools who are already advantaged got more and more of the strong students, the capable students, and few of the ones that caused more of a challenge for the teachers. And then those schools that are already at the bottom, and they rank schools in England on league tables. So you can look up where your school compares to every other school in the country. Those already at the bottom got the students that nobody wanted. And we saw increasing disparities between the schools in England. And so one of the issues is that does markets and that kind of system really work as a way, does it improve education? I'd argue no. And in fact, it increases, and we have lots of evidence, increases inequality in different means by race and class in countries where that's been the model for improving education. So what I want to get away with, one last sentence.
Yeah.
So it focuses on the individual choice, and that's the nature of freedom. I think it's much more valuable, and what we need to have is discuss. You know, I've been a critic of many things that go on in schools. What we need is people actually to work together, to talk together, to work with teachers and community members to talk about how do we improve schools, what do we want, and have that discussion that it's not about individual choice, but it's about communication, developing a collective notion of what is the goal of education, how do we, what do we want to support, how do we support it, et cetera. So it's more complicated than just one person voting with their feet to go someplace else.
All right, I see the phone ringing. Before I get to phone calls, Lyle, there's a lot to digest there.
Yes.
Go ahead.
Well, I study Adam Smith, who a lot of people consider the father of modern economics. Some people even say the father of capitalism. And the more I've studied him, the more intrigued I am by the fact that so much of what he saw in his own time predicted, anticipated a lot of the problems with capitalism and with markets. I'll give you one example. There's a famous section in his in Wealth of Nations where he writes about the degrading effects of wage labor. Wage labor was just beginning to be a widespread way of arranging production in British society at the time. And he was talking about particularly the pin factory. And usually most neoliberals today, most boosters of capitalism today, quote the first section of Wealth of Nations where he talks about the efficiency of the pin factory. Everyone has this specialized task, and therefore they produce far more pins in a matter of an hour than they would if they were all their own individual craftsmen creating the entire pin on their own. What he notes later on in Wealth of Nations is that work routine, it can be very degrading. If you're spending an entire day just doing the same task over and over, it can dehumanize you. And in fact, it was that reality that encouraged Smith to call for public schools and call for public education. He saw education as a way to guard against or fend against this aspect of this kind of rising capitalism that he was writing about. One other example was he talked about the competition, the increasing competition, the increasing battle between laborers and employers. And he noted at the time that employers have far more bargaining power than the workers. The employers have far more money, they have far more resources overall, so if the workers go on strike, the employers can wait it out much longer than the workers can. The workers ultimately need to put food in their mouths. Later on, economists had technical terms for this. You know, bargaining power became a major part of of market thought, and that's really where labor unions come into play, and all sorts of other occupational regulations to ensure that workers have the power they need in the workplace. So.
Well, let me just hit a couple of things, because I know we got a phone call that wants to piggyback on some of David's comments. Before I get to that, two things. On Chait's argument, I think there's an intellectual laziness when he says, well, if modern liberals and modern conservatives can both be neoliberals, then it doesn't mean anything. I don't understand that at all. I mean, certainly part of the argument that people like Matt Stoller have been making for months now with growing prominence is that that's exactly what's been happening since the Watergate babies and the congressional wave in the mid-1970s, taking their eyes off of economic concentration and moving more into sort of a Borkism light, away from the Brandeis camp. And so I think Chait is just sort of being lazy in that regard. And that's a question for the left that we'll explore even more in the next hour with where the left goes next to try to actually win. But I also want to ask you, Lyle, because we're going to go back to education in a second, but let's take healthcare for example. In September 2011, there was a Republican primary presidential debate. Ron Paul was talking about the importance of personal responsibility in insurance and insurance markets. And there was a question of, you know, what happens if someone is not insured, can't afford the coverage, and has a catastrophic illness? And someone in the audience yelled, "Let him die." And the conversation became the next day, well, at least that was intellectually honest. If you really believe in personal responsibility to the extent that says that this isn't a right, that we're not going to do it this way, then the next extension is that you do let people die in those situations as opposed to viewing it a different way. Neoliberalism doesn't come out right out and say let people die if they don't make these choices, but it does sort of commodify things. So why don't you explain for our listeners how you view neoliberalism in healthcare marketplaces and why the current sort of set of the current debate about healthcare is often brought into this question of neoliberalism.
Right. So I would actually argue that the let them die mentality is very much at work in our healthcare market. There are, in fact, a lot of Americans that are dying, and we are letting them die precisely because we are buying in to this idea that that there is no other god than markets. And in fact, if you look at societies with the best healthcare outcomes, they are societies that have rejected this neoliberal idea or this capitalist idea that markets are the most efficient in all sectors.
So you're saying the evidence says
absolutely
that those systems are more efficient with better healthcare outcomes.
Absolutely. Yes. There's really no disagreement within, there might be some disagreement on the margins, but for the most part, most healthcare economists and social scientists, if you actually just look at the empirical outcomes, would agree with what I just said. And I also, just theoretically, there's a famous article that was written by the Nobel Prize winning economist Kenneth Arrow about a half century ago, where he explained why you can't have efficient markets in the healthcare sector. His major reason was there's so much uncertainty, and there's also all sorts of externalities. We can talk about externalities as well, but there's basically positive and negative feedback loops in markets that if they...
That's wonky. Get specific for our listeners real quick.
Okay. Well, I mean, just one example of why you can't really have markets in the healthcare sector is if someone doesn't have money to get treated, to get preventative care, then they are going to get sicker. And eventually they're going to end up in the emergency room. And everyone else is eventually going to have to pay for their ER costs. Now, that's just one example.
But unless you let them die.
Right, unless you let them die, which I think that's, you know, there are, I mean, we are unfortunately letting a lot of people die, even the ones that make it to the ER eventually die in the ER or die somewhere else. But even if you did let them die, so to speak, even if we reached that point in our society where we're letting everyone die, the amount of costs, social costs, of just having all these dead people in our society, all these dying people in our society, those costs would outweigh whatever we're trying to save in the meantime. I mean, it's incredibly expensive to have poor and dying people in your society, especially if they make up the greater part of your society.
And just attempting to use the ER for healthcare.
Right.
Okay. So, listeners, 844-295-TALK, toll-free, 844-295-8255. or 263-WXXI. If you're in Rochester, 263-9994. We are trying to define neoliberalism and understand it as we see it in political conversations, in policy debates, and in the different spheres of our daily lives here. And I know Bonnie in Rochester has a question that comes back to education for David. Go ahead, Bonnie.
Well, I have actually two parts, probably the simplistic part and then the not-so-simplistic part. I think one of the issues, this is probably, you know, self-obvious, but, you know, it always puzzles me as to why the education system, and I mean from, you know, elementary on up and then college even more so, why there isn't more effort to explain these things in clearer ways, similar to what this discussion is, and probably more. Because when people leave school, many of the folks who don't go beyond, you know, high school, and even some, many who do, you know, kind of see the political world as a two-party system, maybe three parties and a conservative addition. So it's usually Democrats, Republicans. They don't really hear the word neo, it's just liberal, and then they kind of, you know, go from there. And a lot of people can't figure out why, when somebody talks about a progressive third party that isn't, you know, is denying, doesn't stand for some of those things, why it's relevant. And so they just kind of, it just gets to be a big mush. So I really feel it's very strongly, and I'm always disappointed at the labor unions who, you know, history, they had some fights with leftist thinking, but why they don't demand more honesty in this discussion, because it's really important. My second point is, and this is probably something for a longer conversation, is that I wonder what the feedback might be on, there's a lot of projection now about the future of work, you know, fewer job options except for some technologies, and maybe even four-hour days, maybe less than that, between climate change and automation and all those things, that it's like a kind of perfect storm. So I guess I would like to know what your guests would say about the kind of system, for lack of a better word, and political involvement would best, in their mind, meet that possibility, both now as a transition and when it would occur.
All right, Bonnie, thank you. David Hirsch, you want to start? Go ahead.
Sure. Those are all great observations and questions. I've been trying to push into schools and through my own teaching over the last now 50 years, I guess, or close to 50 years, more of a discussion on those more complicated issues such as economics, also climate change. The future of work is a great question. One of the things we should be talking about in schools, because we now have, you know, what are the students who are in schools now in middle school and high school? What does their future look like in terms of work? What, you know, how much will they earn? What will be the nature of work when they're ready to go out and look for a job? Unfortunately, my sense is that schools do two things not well, or schools don't do this very well. One is because we're not very good at raising and discussing about controversial subjects or subjects that people that there's already consensus on, and so climate change and lots of other issues get neglected because nobody wants to tackle them because there's disagreement. And we need to be able to, as we do, I think, on this show, there's a sense, yes, there's disagreement between the people calling in, between the people who are sitting here on the microphone, but disagreement is good, and we need to be able to raise questions, what is the future of work, and pursue those. then the second one is the way that schools are organized, in that we have these subjects. We have English, social, and history, math, and science, and people don't look at the ways in which they fit together. And economics gets relegated to participation in government in New York State in 12th grade. And we need to look at these in, again, much more interdisciplinary ways, but our schools do not really make it possible for that to occur.
Okay, Lyle?
I'm going to answer the second part of that question concerning where we go from here, given the rise of mechanization, automation, and all that. So the Center for American Progress, which is more or less a kind of left-of-center think tank in Washington and has been very supportive of Hillary Clinton and the Clintons in general through the years, They surprisingly came out with a plan recently on what's called the job guarantee, where everyone, you know, anyone who wants a job can get a job, and it will be paid at a living wage, more or less. So there's a debate on exactly how to define living wage, but it would be well-paid jobs provided for everyone. That doesn't answer the automation question, but I think there's a big debate on the left about whether we should have job guarantees, whether we should have a universal basic income, which I believe the caller was alluding to.
Yeah, I don't understand why a UBI is not preferable to job guarantees, just because I don't understand how you're going to create a job literally for everybody.
Right. So there's different plans in place. The most popular plan right now amongst the policy wonks is this kind of counter-cyclical plan. So basically, whenever the economy is growing, the job guarantee program shrinks because you have enough jobs out there in the first place. And then when the economy starts contracting, then the job guarantee program kicks into place. It's very complicated, but from what I've read, it could work, and it's worked in smaller, you know, smaller capacities in other countries. The universal basic income, there's a debate. Either we have the job guarantee or we have the universal basic income. I actually think we should have both because, in fact, a lot of people can't work. They're either disabled. They need to take care of their children. A number of reasons why people can't work in a wage workplace. So there needs to be a way to provide for them as well. And then also that I think the universal basic income does answer this question of increased automation. But I would actually add a third approach to our political economy that we really need to be looking at, and which also kind of addresses the rise of automation, which is democratic control of the workplace. Because what's been happening for a number of years now is we've had more and more machines introduced into the workplace, but they've been introduced for the sake of increasing the bottom line for the employers. They haven't been introduced for the sake of making everyone's lives better. So if we have more democratic control over what kind of technology we're investing in, what kind of machines we're investing in, then we can have control in investing in machines that can affect, if you combine it with a universal basic income, that make our work days and our work weeks shorter.
I'm late for a break, but what Lyle just said reminds me of the most recent Radiolab episode, which I urge everyone to listen to. If you want to be concerned about the future of actual fake news, not you know, here's a news story I don't like, therefore it's fake news. What technology is able to do with our words and even our images is starting to get frightening. And we are reaching a possible era where people won't trust anything anymore, which some political actors might be very happy about. But at one point in the episode, they asked the creators of the technology, why are you doing this? Did you ever think about putting the brakes on this? In the same way we might do that with AI or automation. Say, just because you can, should you? And the creators don't really have an answer for that. And so what that leads some in the episode, Lyle, to say is, well, if they didn't do this, somebody else will. In the same way with automation. Well, if the marketplace, or as you say, if we have democratic control of markets, you can't just throw the brakes on this, because somewhere else somebody will do this, and the external pressure will come back to you. Is that something that you're concerned about?
I'm not sure I followed the question.
Okay, so automation. So you're sort of implying, you know, what's the point of automation? Efficiency of production and maybe reducing the actual workforce, right?
Right.
So helping companies, not necessarily making lives better.
Right.
So it's a question of just because you can do something technologically, should you do it?
Right.
And so what you're suggesting is we can create a system where we have more control over that. That maybe we won't do that. But if we don't do that here, and ostensible competitors in other countries are doing it.
Absolutely.
Is there going to be pressure for that to change?
Of course. I mean, we're already beginning to see it. I mean, there's actually a debate amongst economists to the extent to which unemployment in this country or stagnant wages in this country are a result of automation. But I think certainly, regardless of whether that's happening this moment, I think we will see in the future less employment and depressed wages, as long as there isn't democratic control in the decision making. And no matter what, this technology is going to arrive, and we decide as a society whether we're going to use that technology to have shorter work days and shorter work weeks and happier, healthier lives, or whether that technology is going to be used simply to increase the bottom line for the capitalists, for those at the
wealth.
Top, right, while everyone else is stuck with, you know, crumbs. And by the way, I mean, this isn't just a matter of people being stuck with crumbs. I mean, there's all sorts of social consequences to that kind of future. In the past, whenever there's been radical forms of inequality, you've ended up with increased social strife and even revolution. So even from a conservative perspective, this is something everyone should be concerned about.
All right, so this is our only break of the hour, and I'm about 12 minutes late for it. Karen in Rochester, stay on the line. We'll take your call when we come back. We're going back to healthcare as we take a look at neoliberalism, and we'll see what David and Lyle have to say about what Karen has to say. Kelly, I've got an email from you about whether it's fair to call the Obama administration staffed largely by neoliberals because of their efforts on healthcare. Kelly writes and says, Barack Obama wanted the public option and probably wanted single payer if he could have truly gotten his way. He had to play within the system. You can't call him a neoliberal. Well, we'll see what our guests have to say about that. We'll also take a phone call as we continue our discussion. As we talk about this term, we've been seeing a lot and hearing a lot, neoliberalism. What is it? Lyle Rubin is the co-founder of the Rochester Democratic Socialists of America here in Rochester, which you can find them where, Lyle?
You can find them on Facebook at ROCDSA, and you can also find them on Twitter at ROCDSA.
And David Hirsch is a professor of teaching and curriculum at the University of Rochester's Warner School and the author of another book?
No, my most recent book is The End of Public Schools.
The End of Public Schools.
Corporate reform agenda.
You're sort of always writing a book.
I always am.
I know, that's good. But he's author, among other things, of The End of Public Schools. Your comments on healthcare and neoliberalism next. All right, let me get to some of your phone calls. I'm going to start with Karen in Rochester. Go ahead, Karen.
Hi. I wanted to weigh in a little bit on the healthcare issue, so I'm glad that you're turning back to it.
Sure.
I think it's easy to understand why markets don't work for healthcare, because we can't anticipate our needs. We don't know when we're going to come down with a cancer diagnosis or be in a car accident. It's not like buying a TV or a vanity purchase that we're going to Instagram about. As if it's fashionable. So we need health care, and we don't know what those needs are going to be moving forward. It's hard because there's a lack of transparency in the system. We can't price shop when we're going to an emergency room to decide where we can get the best bang for our buck. And it seems like everything about health care works in the opposite direction of capitalist promises. So capitalism promises to increase your choice. Instead, we are limited by our insurance company in network providers. We're told that it'll keep that competition keeps costs down, but there isn't really competition in healthcare when I don't have a choice of where the ambulance driver takes me. There's no way during open enrollment we're told by HR departments that if we take a look at our past costs for our family, we can anticipate the best plan for us this year. And that's really not possible. It's also not possible to choose the best plan when there are no affordable plans. So people, even people with employer-sponsored insurance, which, by the way, is also subsidized by American taxpayers, we can't guess what the best choice is because there is no good choice anymore.
Karen, thank you. Yeah, David, you want to start? Go ahead.
Obviously, health policy is not what I focus on in my work, but I've been watching the debates over the health care bills. And one of the things I've noticed is that many of the people were saying that the Affordable Health Care Act was unsustainable, that we could not afford that program. And in fact, the argument is that any kind of single payer or universal system in healthcare is described as being unsustainable, and therefore we can't do it. We shouldn't even consider it, and you know. And I find that odd. And then I've also heard others say we can't do universal healthcare because it's too difficult, and we don't know how to do it. And yet, all those comments surprise me, given that out of the 34 industrialized countries that have universal healthcare systems, we're the only one that doesn't. We pay about twice as much for healthcare per person and have much poorer results from our healthcare system. So, in fact, our system is working very poorly now. It's costing a lot of money and not getting what we need out of it. And yet, it seems to me this is where the neoliberal mindset comes in. If you argue that only markets and competition and privatization is what will work, then all those who talk about single-payer systems or talk about anything other than what is currently in existence get dismissed. And you know, and I just find it, we're the richest country in the world in terms of individual gross domestic product produced, and yet we have one of the worst healthcare systems in modern society. And clearly, you know, they say, well, if we're trying to talk about what would work, we have models in 32 other countries that are working to better and worse degrees, but there's lots of countries that are doing this, and it seems it wouldn't be hard to go to the countries and figure it out. So I just find the whole debate over why we can't have universal health care to be illogical and founded on false assumptions.
Wow.
So first of all, I wanted to thank Karen for that phone call. I couldn't agree more. Just going back to Adam Smith really quickly, because he's kind of someone I've been devoting my life to for the past 2 years. When he talked about markets, he was talking about small-scale exchange. So he was talking about brewers, butchers, shoemakers. You would show up at a shop front. You would know exactly who you're getting your commodity from. You would know exactly how that commodity compares to the shoemaker down the road or the butcher down the road. You were probably friends with the butcher down the road. So what I'm saying here is that you had a good idea. You had good information. And there was also a certain symmetry of power between the consumer and the seller. But what we're talking about now in the context of healthcare are these massive corporations who are involved in all these highly complicated networks of exchange, networks of production, that your average consumer has no idea what's really going on. And this really goes I guess I'm just kind of reinforcing Karen's point that without a basic information baseline, markets aren't going to work, which is why they don't work in a modern healthcare marketplace.
I'm starting to run out of time, and I'm kind of panicking a little bit. Let me get Kelly's email. And Lyle, she says, Obama wanted a public option. He probably would have wanted single payer if he could get it. He was just a pragmatist. Calling him a neoliberal is not fair.
Okay, so there are aspects of Obama's tenure that I appreciate. I appreciate his tapping of Tom Perez as the labor secretary, for example. But the fact of the matter is that President Obama, when he first went to the Oval Office, picked a cabinet full of bankers, full of corporate leaders, with hardly any labor representation, with hardly any representation from community groups and so on and so forth. And it was actually his advisor, Rahm Emanuel, that advised him against the public option. And that was one of the reasons he didn't push for the public option. And I could go on and on. The whole way that the aftermath of the financial collapse was handled was very much it was handled by Wall Street. I mean, it was Timothy Geithner that led the charge. And there was a number of things that could have been done that weren't done. Most of all, when it came to evictions, when it came to foreclosures, you had millions of people, particularly people of color.
Yeah, read David Dayen's book,
exactly.
D-A-Y-E-N. If you want to read David Dayen's book, you get a real picture of what happened under the Obama administration with foreclosures.
Exactly. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yep.
Yeah. So, but Kelly, I appreciate that email. I got to try to squeeze in a couple more here. Chris in Rochester next. Go ahead, Chris.
Yeah, your information has been really interesting and informative. But I think there's an issue that's more fundamental, and that's this, you might call the social psychology of the American public. I mean, why was it that that's just sort of rolled over and started to worship Ronald Reagan when he came into office? Why was Reagan and what his ethos, why was that so persuasive, especially now that we know that when push comes to shove, when the rubber meets the road, the American public really wanted health care, some kind of a national health care system provided by, you know, public-private thing. In other words, what I'm saying is the persuasive factor of a certain kind of American mindset that I think is really old-fashioned, 19th century, rather judgmental, and in its policies, seems to be more attractive to the American public than the left perspective. And given that fact, I don't, You know, I just think that's an enormous barrier to making the kind of changes that you're talking about, which I am in complete agreement with.
Okay, Chris, thank you.
Yeah, and David? My sense is, and it's by looking at education, is that there's certain words that are used, such as freedom and choice, that are used to get people on the side of those who are against those kinds of notions, such as universal health care. And so the argument becomes difficult for, to make, and we don't have real debates over those issues because of the ways language is oversimplified, misused, or not really examined sufficiently. And that's what I'd like to look at in terms of education and healthcare, et cetera. But I think we tend not to try to understand the issues. We tend not to have a real debate over what the terms mean.
Yeah, just the term redistribution. Mm-hmm. When you hear redistribution, it almost always in political conversation means higher taxes, right, and giving ostensible wealth from the wealthiest to people less wealthy, as opposed to redistribution that Lyle mentioned earlier, which he views neoliberalism as redistributing,
right,
upwards. But mm-hmm. but that's a term, again, that doesn't really have much debate. It's sort of stuck,
right,
in its meaning. In,
exactly.
Yeah, go ahead, Lyle.
So I did want to emphasize that if you actually look at polling in this country, and this actually has stayed somewhat consistent even through the Reagan years and the Clinton years of the 80s and 90s, and it's even become more emphasized since the financial collapse. The people themselves, most American mm-hmm. people are for labor unions. Most American people are for some form of universal health care. In fact, right now, they're openly for a single-payer Medicare for all system. The majority are. The majority of Americans are for steep taxes on the rich. The majority of Americans are for either debt-free college or free tuition college or some variant of the sort. So if you look almost across the board on political economic policy, the American people are well to the left of actually both parties, I would argue. When it comes to the question of what happened, why, if this is the case that the American people support more or less welfare state or social democratic policies, why did we end up with Reagan? Why did we end up with Bill Clinton? Why did we end up with George W. Bush? In a lot, I would argue that in the 1970s, you had a stagnant economy. You had inflation. You had the oil shocks of the 1970s. You had an unbalanced budget as a result of the Vietnam War. It was a very, very difficult time. And as a result, the right, the rising neoliberal right, took advantage of that. And they had a plan in place, and they gradually took over our institutions. They took over our media. We can talk about corporate concentration perhaps at another time. They took over our parties, both parties. So there's a major gap between our institutions and what the people in those institutions believe and want and what the American people want. And that's why someone like Bernie Sanders is so important.
And so that's a good lead into our next hour. Bernie Sanders is going back to Iowa. In fact, as the New Yorker chronicles in their issue this month, their next issue, he's been sort of everywhere. And the question is he the right leader at the top for 2020, for the midterms, even for, you know, the models of politics and trying to run and win for Democrats and for the left locally? So that's the next hour. But let me ask David Hirsch then to put a little cap on this real briefly, because I think even if people don't know what the word neoliberalism means or all agree on it, I think some writers have now argued that the American worker sees it and feels it when jobs are closed, and mm-hmm. we all just go, well, globalization, you know, and so you don't have to sort of understand it to feel its effects. You agree?
I agree. It's happening around us all the time, and I think we get the effects, and we hear it when we hear debates, and neoliberal notions are really underlying the statements that are being made, but we need to interrogate those, ask questions about that, and try to figure out what is the root, where did that, of those particular ideas, and why are they being sustained.
Okay, and Lyle, 20 mm-hmm. seconds, are you at least happy to see more discussion in the public eye about this, Chait's piece among others, even if they're throwing darts at it? What do you think?
Of course. I mean, many of us on the left have had to live in a media moment where neoliberalism was never even mentioned. It was just the water that we mm-hmm. swam in.
Right.
So this is the first time we're actually recognizing the water that we're swimming in, which is very important.
And when I go to country to country, other countries, people know about neoliberalism. In the U.S., they're slowly learning about it 25 years after it was used, well-known in other countries.
All right. Well, David Hirsch and Lyle Rubin coming to us from the University of Rochester in various capacities. Lyle, also the co-founder of Rochester Democratic Socialists of America. And that sets us up for our next hour. So our next hour is, what happens going forward. I know it feels like the endless campaign, and everybody says Canada has an 11-week campaign, but the American left is feeling that crunch right now, trying to figure out the kind of the pivot in the moment, and we're going to explore that in our next hour. Stay with us.